Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Michael Tomasello. He is Emeritus Director of the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig and Professor of Psychology at Duke University. He's the author of several books, including The Cultural Origins of Human Cognition, A Natural History of Human Thinking, A Natural History of Human Morality, and more recently, Becoming Human, A Theory of Ontogeny. So, Dr. Tomasello, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Ricardo.
Okay, so I mean, one of the things that you study is human sociality and human morality, and sometimes you also compare humans to other primates, particularly the great apes. So, how do you look at the sort of biological continuity that there is between humans and other primates?
Well, we share a common ancestor with great apes only about 6 million years ago. So in terms of time and in terms of genetic similarity, humans are as similar to great apes, especially chimpanzees and bonobos, as horses are to zebras, rats are to mice, lions are to tigers. Now, they're all separate species, of course, but from the point of view of psychology, those pairs operate in somewhat similar ways. So that's what makes it such a mystery and such a puzzle that humans have seemingly become so different.
Yeah, I understand. So I read in your work you talk about three different kinds of morality. The first one derived from kin selection and genetic relatedness, the second one derived from reciprocal altruism, and the third one derived from culture. Could you explain that?
Yes, I would say that the reciprocal altruism is not my preferred explanation. I like interdependence, and so and let me explain that. So all right. So first off, the kin selection and all, everybody agrees on that. You have bees and ants and whatever, where individuals sacrifice for the queen, and you have mothers. In mammals, you have mothers sacrificing for their offspring. People say they sort of discount it when they're talking about prosociality and altruism because, oh, well, that's just genetic. But I believe that the basic machinery for sympathy and helping was built for, in that context, for kin selection. And then it's much easier now for individuals to generalize that to others, for there to be an evolutionary process where I've already got the mechanism for sacrificing for my offspring, and now I just need to aim that mechanism in another direction for friends and others on whom I am with whom I am interdependent. So that's the second thing. The machinery was already built, and it got redirected for situations of interdependence. Now, interdependence is the key to get a biological explanation of this of altruism and cooperation, because as everybody knows, evolutionary explanations are about what's in it for the individual. The individual needs to not sacrifice itself out of existence and its offspring out of existence. So interdependence is the transition point because interdependence is situations where I depend on you. It makes no sense to me. Mean to you. I use an example in the morality book. Let's say I'm a male and you're a female, and you're the only female in the whole group that will mate with me. And we approach a pile of food together. I'm not going to take all the food and let you die because then I can't pass on any of my genes. I depend on you as my only mating partner for my evolutionary success. So it is in my interest to share the food with you. And that's an extreme example, but other examples that I depend on you as a cooperative partner in hunting, or I depend on you for grooming if that turns out to be important, or I depend on you for looking out for predators. So whenever there's interdependencies, then it makes sense for me to sacrifice for you. And I, in the book, I even have sort of Hamilton's equation, where the where instead of having a degree of relatedness, it's degree of interdependence. And I actually like to think of it in terms of investment. So, you know, you're really important to me. I need to invest in your well-being. If I need you as a partner to go hunting tomorrow and you're sick tonight, well, it's in my interest to help you get better. So so that's the interdependence enables us to, and sorry, let me say one other thing. This kind of thing is really well known and has been studied for a long time between species. And it's various kinds of parasitism and all of that, where, and mutualisms, where symbiosis. Sorry, I was having trouble recovering that word. Symbiosis. So, you know, the certain species benefit from one another, and they're interdependent with one another, so they help one another. So anyway, this is just generalizing that to within the group. And I think that's a much better explanation than reciprocal altruism. Reciprocal altruism, if it means I have to help you and wait around for you to pay me back, it's just not stable, and you just don't, and you don't really see it. So interdependence doesn't depend on you paying me back. I'm helping you because it's in my interest to help you, not because I'm waiting to be paid back. All right, so there's kin selection, which builds the machinery. There is then interdependence, where that machinery is extended to people with whom I'm interdependent. And then the sort of more human version, you know, gets to be one of obligation and fairness and group relatedness. And, you know, that has a long story behind it, but essentially a cultural group is a group of individuals who are all interdependent with one another, and the children can't survive on their own unless they're taught the ways of the group, and if the group goes dissolves, you're going to get taken over by neighboring groups. And so interdependence still rules, but we get sort of we pull away from the tethering of interdependence, such that anybody who's an in-group member, they don't have it, I don't have to be specifically dependent on them. I just know that in general, you know, it's good for my group if my group is, everybody in my group is healthy and whatever. So, yeah, so that's the sort of idea of how we get an evolutionary grounding of morality in if you think of, you know, needing, the individual needs to take care of themselves, and they and this interdependence allows them to take care of others.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that those two mechanisms, that is kin selection and interdependence, are behind the evolution of emotions like sympathy, empathy, and others?
Yes. And I mean, sympathy, you know, is tied to oxytocin. It's the nursing hormone. It's tied to mothers. Okay, so yes, I would say oxytocin is in all mammals, all nursing mammals. So that's the sort of physical mechanism, yes, that's exactly where it starts.
Mm-hmm. And also behind certain, let's call them perhaps moral values like fairness and justice.
Okay, in my work on evolution of morality, I think fair, you know, sympathy is fairly straightforward. I mean, I just help you, but fairness is really complicated, because fairness, I have to take into account, and I view myself just like everybody else. I treat myself the same as everyone else. And I have to balance different values and whatnot. There are different kinds of fairness. I can do merit-based fairness, that because you contributed more to our joint enterprise, you deserve more. Or you need more because you're hungrier than me. So issues of fairness are quite complicated, and I actually propose that they're really only emerged with humans, where we have these special forms of interdependence, and that other creatures don't have this extra motivational sense of obligation, which is sort of what fairness tends to be. Something sympathy, we just do it because we want to, you know, we feel compassion. And, you know, a sense of fairness is often associated with obligation. I mean, this is what I ought to do. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little bit different, and I do think it's uniquely human.
Mm-hmm. But does it derive from culture? I mean, is there a cultural component to it?
Yes, but I think it starts a little bit evolutionarily. I think it starts with basically collaboration, where you and I agree to do something together, and now we sort of owe one another. We also have partner choice, which again sort of fixes everything, so that if you are not a good collaborative partner, maybe you steal all the food at the end after we collaborate, then I'm not going to choose you again. And so it develops that, you know, I feel an obligation to share the food with you. Let's say we're collaborating to kill an antelope and I kill it on the other side of the rock and you don't really see it. Well, I still feel like I ought to share it with you. You deserve it because we worked hard together. So I think it goes with this collaboration, and then it scales up to culture, as culture is kind of one big collaborative activity. We're all, and I'm thinking now of not of contemporary humans and all their complexity with skyscrapers and culture institutions. I'm thinking of early modern humans, where they have small hunter-gatherer cultural groups. You know, they're like one big collaborative activity where, with division of labor, where some people go hunting and some people go gathering and some people take care of the kids and some people make tools and some people cook. And so it's like one big collaborative activity. And that's the home of the sense of fairness and obligation, is that we're all working hard together. And so we all deserve to share the spoils in a fair way.
I think we will come back to culture later in the interview, but could you explain the concept of shared intentionality?
There are a number of ways to explain it, but I think the way that I like to think about it now is, let's just stick with mammals. I won't get off into birds and other things. Let's just stick with mammals. All mammals are individual agents. They are pursuing their goals flexibly and finding, you know, adjusting to contingencies to achieve their goals. And great apes are too, and they are doing that in perhaps some slightly more complicated ways, but they're also individual agents pursuing their goals. And I think what really happens with humans in, you know, somewhere between a million and a half a million years ago, 400,000 something, they have to start collaborating with another individual to get food. And this collaboration, maybe there were terrestrial monkeys like baboons and stuff who were taking all their fruits and stuff. They were pushed out of their normal ecological niche of fruits and leaves and stuff. So now they got to do something different. And they're collaborating in a way that makes them a kind of shared agent, a kind of joint agent. That's why I started with mammals and agency. So we're working together toward the same goal. The two of us have one goal. We have a shared goal, a joint goal. We're going to get that antelope. And you have your role and I have my role, and we're working together. And it's like an agent, because just like an agent is kind of self-regulating, collaborative partnership, if we want to call it that, with a shared goal, is also self-regulating. If you don't do your part, I say, hey, what are you doing? Come on, get with it. And you say the same to me. And that's considered to be legitimate. You don't just say, get out of here. You say, oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'll get back on the track. So we pursue a goal together. We self-regulate it together. We each play our own role. And I think that's really the most powerful way to think about it, is that we have this new entity, a shared agent. I say in some of my books that if you look at the famous paper by Maynard Smith and Smarthy, I don't know how to pronounce his name, SZ. They say most of the huge leaps in evolution have been when previously separate entities come together into a single unit, like cells coming into organisms and into multicellular organisms and things like that. And I think that's what has happened, is that humans have created a new kind of agency that is a social or a shared agency. And then when you scale that up to culture, you've got an entire cultural group that makes decisions together. You know, where should we pitch our camp? How should we defend ourselves? How should we organize taking care of the kids? So shared intentionality is sometimes called we intentionality. So it's not just I'm doing it, but we are doing it, and we are obligated to one another. So I think that's what happens, and you can see the result of it. You know, everything, all of the things that if you ask a person on the street, you know, what are the most incredible achievements of human beings, I would say almost every single one of them would be something that no individual could do on its own, right? So they would be, you know, cultural institutions and skyscrapers and language, of course, mathematics. And no individual invented language, no individual invented mathematics, no individual built a skyscraper. These are all things that result from us being able to act as joint or collective or shared agents together, mm-hmm. and do things that no individual could do on their own.
Sure. So how do we move from shared intentionality to collective intentionality? I mean, is there a difference there?
Yes, that terminology, it took me a while to stabilize it. So in some of the earlier stuff, I was not precise. But the way I now do it is the term shared intentionality is the general term that covers everything. And collaboration, where it's just two or more individuals collaborating, is joint intentionality. And then culture is collective. And the main difference there, the sort of operational difference there, is that in culture, you're sort of, I still call it one big collaborative activity, but it's with individuals that you don't even know. So again, I'm thinking of a hunter-gatherer culture, but still, in hunter-gatherer cultures, they're comprising hundreds of individuals, and sometimes they live in different settlements and whatnot, but they all speak the same language and whatever. So it's the phenomenon of what are often referred to as in-group strangers. You're still in my group. I can tell by the way you talk and by the way you dress and whatnot. And so I show more sympathy to you. I help you more. I care about my reputation with you more. So anyway, that's the notion of collective is it's not just I have a reputation with you and I can get angry at you if you don't collaborate. The culture is something much larger and more more impersonal and abstract. So it's shared intentionality is the overarching term, and joint for intentionality for collaboration, and collective intentionality for the cultural group.
Mm-hmm. And is collective intentionality behind the development of cultural institutions?
Absolutely. So I would say, I mean, the phrase I sort of use a lot is conventions, norms, and institutions. And so, here's what I would say, that one of the things I did early in my career was on this sort of idea of chimpanzee culture and how human culture is different from chimpanzee culture. I would probably put chimpanzee culture in quote marks, but it doesn't matter. Chimpanzee culture is one thing. Human culture has some special characteristics. And a lot of the early work of both myself and other people was on cultural transmission, because that's the way most of the complicated things we have as humans, they have a history. They're built up over time, and individuals put their heads together not only to collaborate, but also to take advantage of things that people have invented in the past and all that. So that's the transmittive dimension of culture. And biological people always focus on that because the idea is you have genetic transmission and then you have cultural transmission. And these are two different types of transmission. Cool. I'm on board with it. But what I've focused on in the last decade or so is the other dimension of culture. What I would focus on is the other dimension of culture, and that's the coordinative dimension, not transmission over time, but in the moment, you and I coordinate using conventions, okay? We both know that this is the way people in our culture, you know, fish for, you know, collaboratively fish or whatever. You hold the net, I scare the fish over, and I don't ever have to have met you before. If you talk like me and you dress like me, then I know you know how to net fish. So these are conventions that are widely known in the culture, in what's sometimes called the cultural common ground. Everybody knows that everybody knows them. I've never discussed, with you, President Trump, but I know we could start a discussion because I know you read the news or whatever. It's a sort of cultural common ground. And so conventions is sort of the way we do things, our cultural practices. Social norms are the things that we do that we can be criticized for doing them wrong. So you're polite to people and you don't steal from people, and you have all kinds of social norms that people in the group enforce, and they enforce them from a third party perspective. So if I see someone stealing something, assuming I'm not too scared, I'll just say, "Hey, what are you doing?" You know, or throwing trash on the lawn, at the university on the lawn. I'll say, "Hey, what are you doing?" So I enforce the norm. norm is a convention, but with some sort of force behind it. And institutions are sort of scaled up norms. Institutions are these social organizations where they're normative ways of doing things. If you're in a company, the president has certain responsibilities and rights and obligations and responsibilities. And this, you know, this worker has these rights and responsibilities and this work. So they are essentially a systematic form of collaboration where the normative things are set up. So all of these conventions, norms, and institutions, they're the coordinative dimension of how we coordinate our activities by having common knowledge of the rules of the game, as it were, how these things are done. And I would say that you wouldn't see anything like a convention, norm, or institution in other species either. So both the coordinative dimension as well as some special characteristics of the transmitted dimension, all are attributable, in my theory, to shared intentionality, to our ability to put our heads together in special ways.
Mm-hmm. How do you look at the relationship between a particular species' sociality and its morality? Because, I mean, when we study the sociality of a given species, we are trying to understand how individuals interact with one another, how they establish relationships, and that has also something to do with morality, right?
It is, but I would say that there are a lot of definitions of morality and a lot of ways to look at it, but I would say that everyone could agree on one thing, and that is that one thing that morality is not, is morality is not only pursuing your self-interest. Right. So it does, even if I have social, you know, there are other organisms, I'm just pursuing my own self-interest, I don't care about them at all, I would say you can't get morality if that's the way you're operating. So, I actually am a human psychologist who has delved down into the animals. So, you know, my knowledge is maybe not as deep as it should be. But to me, organisms from which humans came ultimately, like fish and reptiles, they tend not to have emotions. Now somebody will say, they can fear a predator or something. Okay, maybe. But they certainly don't seem to have any social emotions. I don't know if they have oxytocin. That's beyond my knowledge. But mammals, you start getting something different. And they lay eggs. So reptiles and fish lay eggs, and the moms go off. They don't even know who their kids are. They can meet their kid later in life, and they don't even know it. So I just think their sociality means that you really don't have anything you would really want to call morality, even in a fairly broad sense of that term. Some of those species are social. Some, a lot of fish species are highly social, but I don't think the individuals are trying to help the other ones or caring for them or whatever. So anyway, I could be wrong about that, but mammals, that's when you start getting, you know, mothers and kids, and you get living in social groups where there are interdependencies. And so that's where you start getting sympathy and whatnot. And so it's tied to interdependence. And, you know, for the most part, reptiles are solitary. They're not very interdependent. Maybe I'll just stay away from fish because I really know nothing about fish. But let's say reptiles, they're mostly solitary. And so there's not a lot of interdependencies. With mammals, there's a lot of interdependencies depending on the species. So that's where it starts.
Mm-hmm. So I think you've already touched on this a little bit, but in your work you distinguish between natural morality and cultural morality. Could you explain that, please?
Yeah, so natural morality is the grounding, and it's grounded in sympathy, which we've talked about, and it's grounded in, for humans, in a sense of obligation and fairness. And I think you can see this in young children. So we have a lot of studies with children right about on their third birthdays, right about age 3. And they both have a sense of sympathy and helping. And they also have a sense of obligation to others. So if they collaborate with another kid, they will share much more freely than they do. They'll share in an equal way that they might not do. If they had it on their own, they may not want to give it up. But if they collaborate, they will. And so I think they have a natural sense of morality with collaborative partners and with others they care about. And three-year-olds are not really cultural beings. I mean, yes, of course, they've been brought up in a culture and they're already speaking a particular language and stuff, but they don't really understand conventions, norms, and institutions, if I can put it that way. And they don't really, they're not really, they haven't really internalized the rules. Let me give you an example. We have an experiment where, and I alluded to it just a little bit a minute ago, the kids pull in some treats together. And we have it rigged so that in the experimental condition, three go to my side and only one goes to your side. And the children, over 80% of the time, the lucky child who got three gives it up and hands it to the other kid. But if they walk in the room and it's three already on my side and one on your side, I just keep the three. If we didn't collaborate, I don't feel that sense of obligation. Now, some people said, wait a minute, parents have taught their kids to share. That's why they're sharing. But I can't believe that parents taught their kids, if you collaborate, you share. If you don't collaborate, you don't have to share. No, the parents are trying to always encourage. So I think that's unnatural. Natural doesn't mean that it's innate, but natural means that it's not taught from the culture. It's not a cultural norm. It's not taught from parents to kids. The kids develop this naturally on their own. There may be learning involved, but it's not following an adult rule. So I would say natural morality is those things that individuals develop on their own with some maturational capacities and with some learning, but it's not taught from the culture. Then after around age three or so, they are learning the particular social and moral norms of their culture, and those will be different from culture to culture. So one claim that this would support would be that children everywhere from age two to three, their moralities are going to be identical. They're going to have the same sense of sympathy, they're going to have the same sense of fairness, and they're not going to be cultural differences. But after age three, and especially four or five and whatever, now you're going to start seeing some influence of the cultural, the particular norms in their culture. So in your culture, it may be impolite to behave a certain way toward adults. And in my culture, it's not. And my mother yells at me every time I behave in that way. And I get the norm. All right. And so now that is a cultural morality. That is a morality that potentially can differ among cultures. In some cultures, it's forbidden to marry your cousin. In other cultures, it's not. There are all kinds of social norms that you learn in your culture, and they're built on the natural morality. They're built on your natural sense of sympathy for your cultural compatriots, for your sense of obligation to your cultural compatriots, but the particulars are particular to particular cultures, and so that's the cultural morality. Jonathan Haidt, I know you have cited him a lot. He is focused on the ways that, for example, there are different cultural norms in India. If you have to place your bed in a certain orientation in your bedroom, and you're obligated to do that because otherwise it might be bad for your whole cultural group. And we don't have that social norm. So that's cultural morality. And it's built on natural morality, but it's different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've already talked about mechanisms like kin selection, interdependence. Would you also include group selection in this picture? I mean, in trying to understand how human morality evolved.
Like many people, I was attracted to group selection at one time, and David Sloan Wilson was very influential on me, and he now gets angry at me all the time because I've sort of decided that I just don't know about it. Boyd and Richardson argue that you have certain conditions that are necessary for group selection, and especially they are homogeneity within the group. Everybody in the group is genetically homogeneous, and homogeneity within the group and heterogeneity across groups. So you're maximally distinct. Then you can be separate selective units because this is different from this. And they argue that in most species, certainly in mammals, there's too much intergroup transfer. In primates, for example, most monkeys, the males leave their natal group and they mate with individuals in the next group. And in chimpanzees and bonobos, it's the other way. It's the females who immigrate between groups. But there's too much gene transfer between groups for this to be working. So I don't know if it may very well work in insects and some other creatures, but let's say mammals and primates and humans, what I have gone for is the Boyd and Richardson cultural group selection. That and that would be that, let's say, early modern humans 100,000 years ago or 50,000 years ago, they're going around in these groups, and they can be selected differently because we have one set of conventions, norms, and institutions, and you have another one. And if our conventions, norms, and institutions are better than yours, meaning they promote cooperation better, so we hunt together better, we share things together better, you guys are a little more selfish and you don't do it as well, then our group might outcompete your group. And because it's not genetic, it's just based on these cultural conventions, norms, and institutions, we don't have to worry about the transfer, because if anybody goes to another group, they adopt the cultural practices of the other group. So they're not taking their genes with them and diluting the conventions, norms, and institutions of the other group. They're assimilating into it. So you keep maximum homogeneity within group and heterogeneity between groups. And in human cultural groups, we know people dress differently than other groups, and they put facial markings on themselves and stuff in order to distinguish themselves from other groups. Our group is not them. We don't even like those guys over there. So I think you have the conditions in early modern humans for cultural group selection, and that's really important for, again, having cultural norms and so forth. And for the broader group selection in general, I don't use that in my account. I'm not saying it doesn't exist in especially perhaps in insects, but eusocial insects. But in the species that are close to humans, mammals, primates, humans, I don't think you need it, and I'm not sure that it occurs.
Mm-hmm. Can we say that the psychological mechanisms that go associated with human morality, they are innate in any way? Because, I mean, we've talked, for example, about natural and cultural morality, and there's many different sources of evidence that point toward a biological basis yeah. for human morality. But on the other end, we also have cross-cultural variations. So...
my answer to that is both. I said before about natural morality, and now I don't like the word innate. I think it's too static of a word, and I use the word natural. Vygotsky used natural versus cultural, and so I adopted his terminology. I don't know what the Russian word was, but the translation is natural versus cultural, and natural means you're getting it on your own. It might be, and I like the word maturation rather than innate. It does mean more or less the same thing, but it's more dynamic. And I think my recent book on ontogeny, I say what we have is maturational capacities. I have the capacity, if I'm developing in a normal environment, to develop a sense of fairness. But I think if you had a child, I've used this all the way back to my first book, if you have a child on a desert island who grows up outside of any social interaction, they might not develop a sense of fairness. They're no other human beings. They don't ever run into another human being. I could easily see that they don't develop a sense of fairness. And that's why I like the term maturation, a maturational capacity that if you grow up in a normal environment, have normal social interactions and normal learning experiences, you will develop this in all the cultures of the world. So 2-year-old children are going to have similar moralities everywhere, because 2-year-old children everywhere have parents, they have siblings, they interact with other people, they get feedback from other people, they get punished when they do things wrong, they get praised. You know, so we have these common experiences. So we have the same maturational capacity across cultures. We have the same kinds of social experiences early in development. And so there's a very strong maturational capacity for what I've called natural morality, yes. And then cultural morality depends on that, and that varies between cultures. So I'm generally agreeing with the way you phrase it, except I don't like the term innate very much.
Okay, what is the importance of language for human morality? I mean, because there are certain aspects here that we are referring to that, I mean, also operate in other species. But if we lacked language, would it be the case that perhaps we would also lack certain aspects of our morality?
That yes, but I think only the aspects that are on the very top of the cultural pile. I have tended my whole career to not resonate with arguments. So I have people in the primate world who want to say, who people like Franz De Waal and Christoph Bosch, who are always pushing that, you know, great apes are similar to humans and they only emphasize the similarities. And I press them to say, okay, I agree, we're highly, highly, highly similar, but what's the difference? And the only thing I can ever get out of them, normally they don't want to answer the question, the only thing I can get out of them is they'll say, well, language. But language is the tip of the iceberg. I mean, language depends on a certain form of social interaction. It depends on cooperative interaction. It's built out of conventions, which are cooperative. It has conventional motives, I mean, sorry, cooperative motives. So I just inform you of things helpfully. I tell you things to help you and so forth. So I have tended always to think of language as being a product of cooperative psychology and culture, and not a causal force so much as an outcome. That having been said, what Vygotsky always emphasized about human culture is that it emanates from these more general psychological capacities, but then it influences them because you're going over time. And so you have children now. I think language could not have evolved without cooperation, shared intentionality. But then once it evolves, children are growing up with language and they're getting social norms are being taught to them through language. And when they object to other people for being unfair, they're doing it in language. And when they're making excuses and apologizing, which is part of our morality of what I owe to you, when I break an obligation, I need to apologize or make an excuse. Those are almost all done in language. One of the things I think is very striking about young children is if they break an obligation, they will either ask permission or they will make an excuse if they've already done it, or they will apologize, or they will feel guilty. I think those emotions are uniquely human. They go with a sense of obligation. They're often expressed in language, but I don't think the essence of them is language. I think the feeling of obligation and the feeling of owing other people is prior to language, but then with language, you can do all these things like make excuses and apologies and stuff. I don't think chimpanzees really feel the same thing, but even if they did, they couldn't express, they don't have the language to express an apology or make a promise or something like that. So language is a really important tool for human morality, but I would think of it more as a tool, and the tool shapes what you can do. Again, this is straight Vygotsky. Vygotsky says, without Arabic numerals, I'm sorry, you couldn't do algebra. You couldn't do most arithmetic, much less algebra or calculus. So the tools enable you to do it. But the tools were created, okay? They were created by people and they had to have certain capacities for creating it. So we created language and now we use it as a tool and it opens up possibilities for doing things that we couldn't do without it. We created the tool and it just opened up all new possibilities.
But do those things that distinguish humans from other species have to be taught by someone, or do children acquire them naturally, let's say?
They acquire many of them naturally, and then others they acquire culturally. I think one thing cross-culturally, I think one thing that everyone would agree on, there's a lot of disagreement between people about how important the role of culture is. Jonathan Haidt would stress how important it is, and other people would stress the more evolved or maturational capacities of kids. But I think one thing that everybody would agree on, no matter their theoretical perspective, is that the younger the children are, the more they're similar across cultures, and the less they're influenced by particularities of their culture. I'm sorry, but one-year-olds are one-year-olds all over. I don't need to see a Portuguese one-year-old. I know what a one-year-old's like. He's just like my American one-year-old that I interact with. But as they get older, then they become more differentiated by culture and different languages, different social norms, different institutions, and so forth and so on. So I think that, you know, you couldn't be, it's not just being taught. We have pets in our home. We have many people in this world who treat their pets, especially dogs, they treat them like they're humans. They talk to them. They let them sleep in bed with them. they apologize to them when they have to leave them alone. They treat them just like they treat their children. Doesn't turn them into humans. They don't have the maturational capacities to absorb this interaction and this teaching. So they're maturational capacities that become realized in the social interaction. And this is why I use the example of the child on the desert island. Without the social interaction, they wouldn't happen. But you need the maturational capacities. And the human case that I think also speaks to this is children with autism. So children with autism, in severe cases of autism, they don't have the biological capacities for shared intentionality. They don't have the biological capacities to learn conventions, norms, and institutions. So you need both the biological capacities that are unique to humans, and you need the ontogenetic niche of humans to grow up in a world where people are using language with you, where they're teaching you social norms and stuff, and to become a fully functioning adult human being, you need both.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned children in a deserted island at a certain point there. So my last question is, would it have to be one children by itself, or if there were several children, could they develop certain...
If we had no ethical principles whatsoever, we could do the experiment. And I've called them, when I said the child on the desert island by himself, I'm not so sure how much you're familiar with English literature, but the child on the island by himself is the Robinson Crusoe example, right? So he's by himself on the island. The children by themselves is the Lord of the Flies. Right, so in Lord of the Flies, these children, these British school children, are in a plane crash and they end up on the island with no adults. So that's the Lord of the Flies example. And there's another example would be, what if the child is raised by other animals? And that's the Tarzan example, which is also a famous book in English literature. So you can imagine any of these, and what the prediction would be would be very interesting. I use the child on the desert island, the Robinson Crusoe example, because it's the most stark one. But I think if you had a whole group of children who grew up by themselves, this would be what do they create? Could they create a culture? And I just don't know the answer to that. I really don't. There are these wild children who grew up in the forest and stuff like that, but you know, there are all kinds of problems. They haven't really collected the right kind of data, number one. Number two, there are people who speculate the reason they're out in the forest is because they had mental problems to start with, and that's the reason their parents put them out there. So I don't know. Anyway, interesting question. I would say that if they grew up in a peer group for their whole lives, they would probably still do some things. But whether they would create cultural norms and communicative conventions and stuff, I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So let's end the interview here, Dr. Tomasello. And before we go, would you like to mention some places on the internet where people can find your work?
I have something like 9 books, and they're all out there somewhere. Google Scholar has all of them on there somewhere, and Amazon has them all on there. But most of my papers are on Google Scholar, is the most straightforward place. I'm not I'm a little past the generation where everything happens on the internet. So the sort of traditional places. My CV is, I have a website for my lab at Duke, and it's got my CV on it, and it's got some papers on it and stuff that you can download. But most of them you can download from either. You can download some from the Max Planck website also, but almost all the ones you can download from the Max Planck and from the Duke website, you can download from Google Scholar also. So they're out there.
Yeah, I will leave some links to all of that in the description box of the interview. And Dr. Tomasello, thank you for coming on the show. It was really fun to talk to you.
Ricardo, thank you very much.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've been doing this channel for 3 years, bringing you top academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. And I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. Even $1 would already be a great help. Otherwise, you also have links to PayPal in the description box of the interview. And please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button if you liked the interview. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Perolga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunda, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Anian Kata, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arnold Wolf, Tim Hollisey, Henry Kalanias, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetriou, Robert Windegger, Rui Inácio, Arthur Coe, Zoop, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Michael Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Thiago Nunes, Bernard Hugney, Alexander Dunbauer, Omri Hickson, Fergal Cusson, Yevhen Bodrenko, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Don Ross, João Alves da Silva, Jonathan Librant, Oslem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Staten T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Eira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Deza Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adaner Usmani, my producers, Izar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stafiniak, Ian Gilligan, Sergio Quadriano, Luis Caetano, Matthew Lavender, Tom Van Egdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardas France, and Niruban Balachandran, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, and James Pratt. Thank you for all.